Hi, I'm Brad Marshall, your host on Fire in a Bottle, the podcast. I am also the author of the Fire in a Bottle blog. And, you know, the blog and this podcast talks about obesity, and it's framed through a lens of my understanding of molecular biology and my historical knowledge of food, because I love food and food history. And I've also been a chef and a pig farmer. And so that all kind of plays into my worldview about obesity and how it works. And I believe that obesity is not caused by sloth and gluttony. I believe that it is in fact caused by specific enzymes and specific pathways in our body. I believe it's caused by lack of reactive oxygen species generation in the mitochondria. And I think it's fascinating when we think about this in historical context. So we're going to talk about polyunsaturated fats. We're going to talk about hibernating animals. We're going to talk about Native American traditions. We're going to talk about traditional chefs and monks and what they bring to the discussion. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Hopefully it's going to be funny, because, you know, humor is an end in itself. It's important. We have to laugh, right? Laughing is good. We like laughing. I will often talk about we it's just me, but you know, when I was running the restaurant, I had this friend Steve is funny. We like him. He makes us laugh. And he would have a song that he'd like, and he'd be playing on his phone, and he would come and he'd set his phone in front of me, and he would say, "We like this song," you know, meaning really he liked this song, but he was sharing it with me, and obviously already explaining to me that I also liked it. And so when I say we, I mean it in the Steve sense of, I mean me and I mean you, the listener. And so just that's, so if you might be wondering who I mean every time I say we, it means you. Fun. Anywho, I hope you enjoy it. I hope you laugh, and I hope you learn something. And then one more thought before we really get rolling. When I write my blog, I make sure that everything is referenced and double-checked. And that takes a long time, and it slows down, you know, how fast I can talk about things. And you know, writing takes time. So this podcast is sort of meant as a supplement to the blog, but it's also meant to be you know, a little more fun and kind of off the cuff. And sure, maybe I'll say some things that later I realize I was wrong about, but, you know, it's meant to be more narrative. We're going to tell stories. We'll probably have some interviews. In fact, we're going to interview David Tillman, maybe in episode 2, and he has done very well on the croissant diet. So that's a really interesting story. The croissant diet is something I invented to prove a point about the different kinds of fats, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. So anyway, again, hope you like it. So for this first episode, I'm going to tell the story of the squirrel and the acorn. I live in upstate New York, and for the past 800,000 years or so, the climax vegetation of New York State has been a mile-deep sheet of ice, glaciers, right? And the glaciers have been here 85% of the time-ish, roughly every 100,000 years or so. We go through a cycle of, you know, 85,000 years of glaciers, and then we get a brief reprieve from the glaciers, which they last around 15,000 years, perhaps. And that's what we're in right now, is an interglacial. And this current one has already gone on for at least 12, 13,000 years. Some people say as long as 17,000 years, which is to say that it is time for the glaciers to come roaring back down the Canadian plains and, you know, bury us again. But as you may have heard, so we burned all these fossil fuels, right? And then the carbon went into the air and it's like a blanket. And so it's warmer right now than, you know, it has been. And so maybe the glaciers won't come roaring back down. We're not sure. And so, you know, so maybe we beat the glaciers. Obviously, that wasn't what we were trying to do. But anyway, here we are. And this story is about squirrels and acorns. You're probably wondering what this has to do with glaciers. And the thing is that, okay, so when the glaciers are here, where are the trees, right? Well, it turns out they're like chilling in Miami or, you know, maybe Louisiana, southern Mississippi. They go to the south, right? That's the point. And then the glaciers recede, and this has happened a whole bunch of times. And when the glaciers recede, there's this kind of foot race, right? The trees have to get back north, and it is kind of a race because, so maple trees are very shade tolerant. So if you have sort of a forest, like a, what they call a climax forest, which is a kind of a very new ecosystem, they probably didn't exist previously because there was elephants and mammoths and they knocked down the trees. And then the Native Americans used a lot of fire to keep trees clear. So, but in a climax forest, you end up with a lot of maple trees because the little trees can live in the undergrowth. They can live in the shade, and I have them in my woods, and they just sit there year after year after year. I don't know how long they can do it. They can probably live 100 years in the shade, these little maple saplings waiting for the tree above them to fall down. And then the sunlight hits them and they, you know, burst up in this burst of growth. And then they end up being the canopy species. Oak trees can't do that. Oak trees are not at all shade tolerant. And so they really, if oak trees are going to be part of the forest, they really need to get there first. And interestingly, the first recorded evidence that we have of what, this part of the world looked like was when the first Europeans got here. And it turns out that indeed there were many oak trees and a lot of even oak savanna where you have grassland with oak trees in there. And so the oak trees did very well at running back up here as the glaciers receded, right? And we know how the maple trees got here. Their seeds have whirligigs on them. That's the technical term. And the whirligigs blow in the wind, right? So we know how the maple trees move up. That's pretty easy. And then when you think about the oak trees, you know, acorns just fall on the ground. They don't blow in the wind. And so how do the seeds get, you know, moving north, right? And of course, the answer is that the oak trees have little furry buddies, mammals called squirrels. And the squirrels collect the acorns and they run ahead with them and they bury them in the ground in these little seed caches, right? And then, you know, hawk eats the squirrel and the squirrel doesn't collect the acorns that it's buried and it grows into a new oak tree. And that is how, and that's how oak trees get around. So it is the evolutionary imperative of the oak tree that its squirrels do well, right? And in upstate New York, we have long, cold winters. So those squirrels need to fatten up for winter. They need extra energy stores to get through the winter. And so the oak tree has evolved to put the most fattening fuel into the acorn, right? And what is that fuel? Well, it's starch, it's monounsaturated fat, and it's polyunsaturated fat. That is a magical kind of a fattening blend, if you will. And I've written on my blog about this. You know, if you look around the world, at some place, you know, Kuwait has one of the most obese populations in the world, and they have a diet where they're eating flour, white flour, and rice, and vegetable oil, right? Monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fats. That's mainly the diet. And they're very obese, and that's different from historical France, where the diet would have been flour and butter, a more saturated fat. And so, anyway, brief aside, back to the squirrels. And so the oak tree has absolutely optimized the fattening power of the acorn. So why are the contents of acorns so magically fattening? Let's start with linoleic acid. Linoleic acid is a polyunsaturated fat. Polyunsaturated fats, so saturated fats are straight, like a 2x4, and they pack together very tightly. And at room temperature, they're waxy, very, very hard fats. And every time that you introduce a double bond between fats are chains of carbons, and typically they have four bonds, and they're in a chain. So they're connected to one carbon in front of them and one carbon behind them and one hydrogen on the right and one hydrogen on the left. And when the chain's all connected that way, it's straight and the fats have a high melting point. When you introduce a double bond, what you're doing is you're removing two of the hydrogens on consecutive carbons, and now you have two bonds between those two carbons, and they still have a hydrogen on their left, and they still have four bonds total because one bond to the carbon behind them, two bonds to the carbon in front of them, and one bond to the hydrogen on their left. And what that does is it introduces a kink into the fat. And so now it's shaped like a boomerang rather than a 2x4. And boomerangs don't pack together as tightly as 2x4s. And so those fats kind of flow around each other. And that's why unsaturated fats are more liquid at the same temperature. And you can prove this by taking some corn oil. Corn oil is polyunsaturated. It's made mostly of linoleic acid, which has two double bonds. So it's shaped like a C. It's got, you know, it's got two bends in it. And that's really liquid. You put that in the fridge and it is still a liquid. Anyway, end of primer on fats. So there's an experiment that I talk on my blog, and this is very interesting. So mammals are warm-blooded animals, right? You know, snakes are cold-blooded. They have to like sun themselves on a rock for like 2 hours before they can get around, right? And we don't have that. We wake up, we drink like 3 quarts of coffee, and then we can go do whatever we want without having to sun ourselves. And so anyway, so that's great for getting around, but it's disadvantageous because it takes a lot of calories. Warm-blooded things need to eat more often. So because of this, before we have some common ancestor that we share with birds and mammals. Birds and mammals are both warm-blooded, and they both have an alternate metabolic state called torpor. And what torpor is opportunistically, we can turn off our warm-bloodedness. And this is what a ground squirrel, a Midwestern squirrel, does when it wants to hibernate. So it shifts which enzymes it's making. And when winter comes, the days get shorter, it gets cold, the squirrel goes into its nest and goes to sleep, and it doesn't eat for the rest of the winter, and it can lower its body temperature down to like 40 degrees Fahrenheit, I think, which is like 5 degrees Celsius, something like that, maybe even colder than that. So they don't quite freeze solid, but you know, they reduce their metabolic rate by 75-85%, right? And so that program of torpor was programmed into the first mammal, right? And we evolved from that mammal. So we all have that program. And it turns out that if you take two squirrels, two hibernating species of ground squirrel, or two individuals from a hibernating species of ground squirrel, and you put them in a laboratory and you feed one of them food that has sufficient linoleic acid, the polyunsaturated fat found in corn oil and soybean oil, and the other one, you don't give them any fat. You just feed them mostly starch, or you feed them very little polyunsaturated fat. Only the one, and then, well, then what you do is you start making the days shorter by just, you know, turning the lights off earlier, and you turn up the air conditioner and you make it cold, and then you take the food away, right? So now, because the squirrels don't eat during the winter, right? They fast all winter and they hibernate. And so what happens is the squirrel that got enough polyunsaturated fat, when you make the day shorter and the room cold and take the food away, that one curls up and goes to sleep, and it sleeps that way through the winter. The one that you didn't give enough polyunsaturated fat to, that one fails to hibernate, and in fact, it maintains its high metabolic rate and burns through its entire winter store of calories in about 9 days. Because polyunsaturated fat is the key to getting a torpid metabolism. So as a mammal, if you want to lower your metabolic rate and be able to store fat, the key is, well, one of the keys is getting enough linoleic acid. And that is why, right, the oak tree has evolved so that a significant portion of the fat in that acorn is linoleic acid, because it needs its little helper buddies to be able to hibernate and survive the winter, right? Okay. Apologize in advance. We're going to dig into some molecular biology here. I will try to make it as painless as possible. Some of the words are long and hard to pronounce. Also, as soon as this episode is over, I'm going to show up at your door and hand you a quiz to make sure that you memorize all these hard words. That's actually a joke. I don't really know where you live. Seriously though, don't worry about the words. It's fine. Just try to remember the concepts, I guess. Right. So we're talking about linoleic acid, which is a polyunsaturated fat. And polyunsaturated fats have a couple interesting properties. One, they're very easy to oxidize. And two, the body uses them as signaling molecules. And polyunsaturated fats can and will oxidize on their own. And you've probably all seen examples of this. So flaxseed oil is very high in what's called alpha-linolenic acid, which is a triply unsaturated omega-3 polyunsaturated fat. And if you leave it out, if you boil it, those fats oxidize and it becomes linseed oil, which is like wood polish, right? And so those triply unsaturated omega-3 fats, they oxidize on their own much more easily than does linoleic acid, the doubly unsaturated omega-6 fat. Regardless, when the polyunsaturated fats are in your body, most of the time when they oxidize, it's because there's an enzyme whose job it is to oxidize them, not just because, you know, they got oxidized automatically, although that also happens. And so here's an example of signaling through oxidized polyunsaturated fats. So we have a couple enzymes. There are lipases and there are these enzymes called COX-1 and COX-2. And COX-1 and COX-2 are known as cyclooxygenases, right? Doesn't matter really what they're called, but they oxidize polyunsaturated fats. That's their job. And when you eat linoleic acid, much of it is converted to this thing called arachidonic acid. Again, don't worry about the name. There's a couple enzymes that do it, D5D and D6D. If you have activity of both of those enzymes, you're going to convert a certain percentage of the linoleic acid that you eat into arachidonic acid. When you have a headache, it's because a lipase enzyme has been activated, and what that does, the arachidonic acid is mostly held in cell membranes. And so the lipase will release the arachidonic acid out of the cell membranes, and then the cyclooxygenases, COX-1 and COX-2, they will oxidize that arachidonic acid into things called prostaglandins. And prostaglandins signal inflammation. And so if you have activated lipase and COX-1 and COX-2 in your brain, you're going to get a headache. And what aspirin does and what ibuprofen does is they both block the enzymes COX-1 and COX-2. And so the reason that your headache goes away when you eat aspirin is that you have blocked the oxidation of polyunsaturated fats, right? And so that's an example of polyunsaturated fats and the oxidation thereof in the real world that we're all familiar with, right? And so when we talk about animals entering into torpor, or just simply not even necessarily entering into torpor, but just getting fat, a similar process is happening. And here's how it works. You eat linoleic acid. Your intestines pack that into things called chylomicrons. And they're like little rafts or boats, and they float around in your bloodstream, and the fat is packed into them. And if your tissues are hungry, they'll, you know, take a bite off of them and take in the fat and use it for fuel. And the chylomicrons float to the liver, and the liver grabs them out of the blood and it repacks them into things called VLDLs. And of course, if your lunch is full of linoleic acid, the VLDL will be full of linoleic acid. And again, the VLDL floats around, and cells take a bite out of it, and it eventually becomes LDL, which is also known as bad cholesterol. You've probably heard of it. Now, if your bad cholesterol is full of linoleic acid, some of that linoleic acid is going to oxidize, and that is called oxidized LDL, OxLDL. And the thing about that is the oxidized LDL goes to your liver, or as it passes through your liver in the blood, it signals to a signaling molecule on the outside of the liver cell called TLR2 or TLR4. And that TLR2 via NF kappa beta, stimulates this thing called the aryl hydrocarbon receptor. It's a long name, but here's what the aryl hydrocarbon receptor does. It's a transcription factor, which means that it controls the activity of other genes, and it upregulates a lipase and genes that oxidize polyunsaturated fat, right? And that sounds familiar because that's exactly the thing we just talked about in our brain that causes headaches, right? Except when that process happens in your liver, what those polyunsaturated fats do is they activate another transcription factor called PPAR gamma. And when PPAR gamma is activated in your liver, it turns on yet another transcription factor called SREBP1C. And that transcription factor turns on what are known as lipogenic genes. And lipogenic literally means fat making. And so these oxidized PUFA, when made by the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, which was in turn stimulated by oxidized linoleic acid in your, LDL, turns on PPAR gamma, and PPAR gamma turns on lipogenic genes. And lipogenic genes in your liver, guess what? Make you fat. They give you fatty liver disease. And they initiate the process of fat storing as opposed to fat burning, right? Or just calorie burning in general. When these lipogenic genes are turned on, it's a signal to store fat. And guess what the fuel for lipogenesis is? It is the starch in the acorn. So if you eat the starch and the linoleic acid together, you are signaling, okay, these polyunsaturated fats, once they become oxidized, are a signal to the body to use the starch in the acorn to make more fat, right? And that's how it works. And so that is why the acorn is packed with linoleic acid and starch. Okay, so that accounts for the linoleic acid and the starch. And then there's one other component of acorns, which is oleic acid, which is an 18-carbon monounsaturated fat. And so this process of fattening, right? It's not a pathology, right? It's not something that's wrong with us. It is in fact an evolutionary advantage in certain circumstances that we all have the program built into us, right? And so it is the prerogative of the organism that if winter really is coming, once you begin the fattening process, you want to continue the fattening process, right? Winter's long and it's cold and you need that fat to get by if you're a bear or a hibernating ground squirrel. And so the end product of lipogenesis, making fat, is typically oleic acid. So what happens is SREBP1C is upregulating the lipogenic genes. One of them is called fatty acid synthase. That makes a 16-carbon saturated fat called palmitic acid. Another one's called elongase, and that adds two more carbons to it to make it 18 carbons long. And then another enzyme called SCD1 introduces a single double bond to that, what is now stearic acid, the 18-carbon saturated fat, and turns it into oleic acid, the 18-carbon monounsaturated fat that's shaped like a boomerang. And so when you look at things that are fat, when you look at things that are torpid, they have lots and lots of oleic acid. That's the thing that tends to build up because you have high levels of fatty acid synthase and elongase and SCD1. And so much of the fat being produced in de novo lipogenesis gets made into oleic acid. So, you know, the organism is a collection of tissues that communicates through the bloodstream, right? And so when the organism sees in the bloodstream a lot of linoleic acid combined with a lot of oleic acid, it says, oh, we are in fattening mode, right? That's what the combination of linoleic and oleic acid looks like to the organism and to the tissues. And so they're going to make different decisions about whether or not they're going to burn or store fuel based on the composition of what's the fats that are in the bloodstream, right? And like I say, so a lot of times in biology, we have things called positive feedback loops. And the end of this process that I described of the oxidized LDL triggering the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, which makes oxidized PUFA, which triggers PPAR gamma, which then triggers lipogenesis. The very end of that cycle is a positive feedback loop. So oleic acid, if there's a lot of oleic acid, you'll make more SREBP1C. If you make more SREBP1C, you'll make more fatty acid synthase, SCD1, elongase, and the other lipogenic genes. And so you have this positive feedback loop. Why? Because once an organism begins to fatten, it is the prerogative of the organism to continue to fatten because that means winter coming, right? Once you've switched on these lipogenic genes, they are self-reinforcing. And that's why once you're fat, it's hard to lose weight because, you know, when you look at humans, there is a very strong and very direct correlation between the amount of the enzyme SCD1, which is what makes the oleic acid, and your BMI. So the more SCD1 you make, the fatter you're going to be. That seems to be the case in actual walking around humans, right? So when you add a significant amount of oleic acid into the fat of the acorn, you're again, it's like the triggering event of torpor is the linoleic acid. But once you become torpid, the signal now becomes the oleic acid. That's the signal to the organism that, like, okay, now we're torpid. We're doing de novo lipogenesis. We need to keep doing lipogenesis. And the organism knows this because of the oleic acid. And so that is why the combination of starch, linoleic acid, and oleic acid is particularly fattening. This next bit is about ancestral wisdom. We like ancestral wisdom. So the Native Americans living in, you know, what's now the U.S., one of their staple foods was acorns. And this is true, you know, throughout much of North America, really. And in fact, the California Native Americans never grew domesticated corn. They, of course, had the option to. Corn was around. They knew about it. But the acorn gathering was so easy that and they were so plentiful that it didn't seem worth the effort of growing corn, presumably. And they never took it up. And interestingly, so on my blog, I wrote an article with anecdotes that on both the East and West Coast, Native Americans would remove the oil from the acorns. On the East Coast, they would grind the acorns into meal, and they would boil the meal for, and I quote, half the day. I don't really know how long that is, 4 hours, 6 hours, 12 hours, I don't know. But for a long time. And then the oil would flow to the top of the water, and they would skim the oil off before eating the starch that was left. Now, this is even more interesting because the Native Americans were not averse to combining starch and fat. In fact, they would take deer suet, which is a very saturated fat that's in the kidney fat of the deer, and they would use that as a kind of butter for their, you know, their corn cakes or their acorn cakes or whatever. Additionally, a staple food of the Native American was bear fat or bear grease. And this is one of my favorite recipes. This is my favorite Native American recipe. So in late winter, in March, was maple sugar season, right? So they'd be out in the forest making maple sugar. And around that same time of year, hunting parties would go out and they would hunt bears. And they mostly hunted the bears for the fat, and they would render the fat and they would keep it all year. And it was kind of a staple of theirs. But in the winter, while they were at camp, and for perhaps several months, this was the staple. This was their staple dish. And what it was you took bear fat and you added to it a bunch of maple sugar until it was, quote, almost as sweet as the maple sugar itself. And if you had some cornmeal left from the previous season, they would add cornmeal to it, and then they would roast venison, or they would make jerky, and they would dip their roasted venison or their jerky into this sauce of maple sugar and bear fat, right? So they're not, certainly not averse to combining fat and, you know, carbohydrates, right? It was specifically the acorn oil that they didn't want. And when you think about bear fat, you know, one of the things that differentiates bear fat from acorn oil is it has a, not a huge quantity, but a significant quantity of stearic acid. And if you're doing a lot of de novo lipogenesis, you don't make a lot of stearic acid because most of the stearic acid gets converted to oleic acid by SCD1, right? And SCD1, of course, is directly related to how fat you are. And when there's a lot of SCD1, it means you have lots of oleic acid and not much stearic acid. And so eating that bear fat, you're sending one signal to your cells through stearic acid. That is to say, we are well fed right now. This fat is coming from our diet because there's a lot of stearic acid in it, as opposed to we are fattening up for winter and we're converting all the stearic acid to oleic acid, right? So that's one signal that's being sent by the bear fat. But I said something else very important. They hunted the bear in March. And you think, okay, what's wrong with that? Well, by March, the bear's already been hibernating 4 or 5 months, and it's lost, you know, half of its body fat. And so it seems odd that the Native Americans would hunt the bear at the very time of the year, right? They're hunting the bear for their fat. And it's odd that they would hunt the bear at the time of year when their fat content was lowest. But in fact, what happens is as the bears hibernate, they preferentially burn the polyunsaturated fat. And so bears have only half as much polyunsaturated fat in March as they do in November, right? And one of the reasons they hunted them in the winter is obviously it's easier to catch a bear while it's hibernating, right? It's a dangerous animal. And you get it while it's sleeping. But, you know, the bears were also sleeping in November, and they could have killed them in November, but they didn't. They waited until March because they knew that the quality of the fat was better in March than it was in November. And that's because, you know, the amount of linoleic acid was lower in March. My stearic acid was higher. Of course, they didn't know that the oleic acid was, they didn't know it was linoleic acid specifically. They just knew it was better in March, right? And so, yeah, and so you have this ancient wisdom. The Native Americans knew that the acorn oil was bad and that the bear fat was okay in March specifically, right? And so when, you know, whatever, Ansel Keys in the 1950s and 60s started promoting polyunsaturated fat, had nothing to do with obesity, of course. It was to supposedly prevent heart disease, which didn't really work. And, you know, he wasn't thinking about ancestral wisdom of Native Americans, obviously. That, I think, will wrap up episode one. I think we thought it was good, right? I think we do think that. Tune back in. There's going to be lots more content. I've got a lot of things to talk about. I've got a great interview coming up with David Tillman, who did really well on the croissant diet, supplementing with stearic acid. Got totally shredded. So that's going to be a fun episode. And also, you know, I want to talk about ways if you want to support the fire in a bottle efforts and what we're doing. You can go to the blog fireinabottle.net. We have metabolic products for sale. Stearic acid, supplemental stearic acid, although that is currently, unfortunately, out of stock, and there's nothing I can do about it for another month or so. There is some of the stearic acid enhanced butter oil, which you can use like regular butter, and it gives you an extra kick of stearic acid. There's also the sterculia oil, which is an inhibitor of the SCD1 enzyme, which is what creates the positive feedback loop of oleic acid, leading to more lipogenic genes, leading to more oleic acid. And then coming in soon, they're not ready yet, unfortunately, but we're going to have some t-shirts. So you can be the first one on your block with a super amazing Fire in a Bottle t-shirt. The first one is going to be the, what is actually the logo for this podcast, but it's two mammals. One of them is the gray lemur, which is a primate, so it's reasonably closely related to humans, that goes into torpor. And the other one is a spiny anteater, which is literally the furthest away from us related mammal. They lay eggs. So you've got an egg-laying mammal and a primate, both of which can go into torpor, thus showing how widely shared this program of torpor is amongst mammals. And at the bottom it says, "You a mammal, bruh?" And it's pretty good. The animals are cute. It's illustrated by A De Vivo. They've been working with me for a long time. They are also available to do cute illustrations if you need cute illustrations done. And then lastly, I sell pork over at firebrandmeats.com, and that is a special breed of pig fed a special diet, and it's all about making the fat content of the meat more healthful. And so I just sent in a sample of my lard and a sample of lard rendered from Smithfield bacon, and my pork fat was 13.4% stearic acid, and theirs was 9.6%, and my pork was 6% linoleic acid, and theirs was 15.6% linoleic acid. And so you know, you can see that what you feed the animals and the genetics of the animals has a huge difference on the healthfulness of the fat in the meat. Also, I'll put this in your head. You're pretty similar to a pig, you know, metabolically speaking. And the fat that you eat also changes your body fat. So I'll leave you, I'll leave that in your head for next time. See you tomorrow.